This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Northwest Connector, connecting riders to the Oregon coast through daily round-trip bus routes from Portland, Salem, and Corvallis. Northwest Connector buses are equipped with bike racks and offer 3-day and 7-day passes with transfers up and down the coast. Schedules and trip planner at nwconnector.net.
This KABU program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or wilkincpas.com.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. The combined results of unfettered industrialization and climate change are thrusting the Gulf Coast toward ecological disaster. The region's impending environmental crises, sea level rise, disappearing coastal wetlands, and the increasing threat of catastrophic hurricanes have much to do with its intensely developed oil and gas infrastructure. While even the oil and gas industry acknowledges its role in creating this crisis, there is little political will to hold it accountable. I spent several days in New Orleans this month attending the Society of Environmental Journalists annual conference, where I had an opportunity to talk with a number of people about Louisiana's position in the crosshairs of environmental catastrophe. One of the people I most enjoyed talking with was Mark Sleevestein, environmental reporter for the New Orleans Times-Picayune. This morning we have Mark with us to talk about the impending disasters facing Louisiana and efforts to mitigate some of the damage inflicted by canals, drilling, dredging, and fracking. Mark, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thank you.
And I want to start by talking about what you think sets Louisiana apart in terms of the environmental concerns it faces and the way that it's dealing with these concerns.
Well, you know, we're at the end of the largest river on the North American continent, the Mississippi River. And so we have a real international size delta that we live in, and it's a living, moving delta over a geologic time. But our problems really started at the end of the 19th century when we decided that we were going to lock the Mississippi River in on a particular course that goes through New Orleans and down to the Gulf of Mexico. By doing that, we've cut off access to the sediment deposits that are carried by the Mississippi River from the Midwest and elsewhere. 40% of the nation's area is actually drained by this river. So we're losing all of this sediment that's washing off upstream, while at the same time the upstream areas have actually done quite a bit to limit the amount of erosion that's going on up there. So we lost the ability of building new wetlands naturally. And that's the beginning of our problems. In the 20th century, as we have become more enamored with oil and gas as a fuel source, it turned out that the Gulf Coast also is a major location for deposits of oil and gas. And so there were significant efforts to develop those resources, which meant the creation of a variety of different canals that are used to locate and drill for oil all through the wetlands along our coast. And those canals themselves have added to our problems in that they obviously, by cutting through the wetlands, they destroy the wetlands. But in addition to that, they provide opportunities for salt water from the Gulf of Mexico to move up into freshwater wetlands and also help destroy them. You add that, and there are a variety of other ways that our coast is eroding away.
Well, I want to sort of help to set the scene for listeners who aren't familiar with southeastern Louisiana to describe what that whole wetland system is, because it's very different, like, from the wetlands we have here in the Northwest. So how would you describe what was there back in the days of Jean Lafitte, and then what's there now?
Well, when Jean Lafitte was pirating out of New Orleans and areas to the south in the 1700s, that area largely was basically right at sea level or a little bit above sea level height of wetland grasses. Ironically, some of those grasses are actually now invasive species in your area, like Spartina alterniflora. But those sorts of grasses actually did act as a break for storm surge, and it was considered land, although it's not a traditional land process. And indeed, that also was a problem. In the 1840s, there were several acts that went through Congress to find ways of turning those wetlands into hard ground or developing them as farms, which also resulted in the loss of wetlands, because a lot of those early farms very quickly eroded away.
Well, there's a lot of talk in terms of climate change, the concerns about sea level rise. But here in the Northwest, it's still kind of a conjecture. It's a hypothetical reality that isn't really probably going to affect us in Portland very much at all. But I was really amazed at the conference to, like, see evidence of sea level rise. And I guess Louisiana is one great example. South Florida is another example. So let's talk a little bit about the combination of what's happening with climate change that's pushing these events and the ways that the oil and gas industry and other kinds of development in Louisiana has just kind of invited sea level rise to happen.
Okay. Well, first you have to understand how our sediment-driven delta works, and that basically is that you put out a bunch of sediment in that area and it creates land. But that sediment is made up of sand and organic material and water, and over time it's going to sink under its own weight. So that sinking process continues. If the Mississippi River's sediment is cut off from those wetlands, you don't have the sediment to keep nourishing those wetlands, and they begin to sink. So we have subsidence that we add to the actual water rising that's going on along our coast, and that results in what we call relative sea level rise. And our relative sea level rise is probably at a much higher rate than most other areas in the United States, and is leading, actually, one of the leading rates in the United States. And so the result of that is that unless we figure out ways of increasing the amount of sediment we can get into those wetlands, we are actually looking at water right on the edges of our levee system in another 50 years if nothing's done.
Well, in an article that was featured on ProPublica a couple weeks ago about, it was called Losing Ground, and start that with Louisiana is drowning quickly. And there's a very graphic photograph, aerial photograph, of what were wetlands, and all you can see are the kind of the tops of the spoils, the canal spoils, I guess. And it's then there's pictures of what it used to look like when it was actually a functional wetland. So it seems like that there's really been a dramatic change, and that people, it's something that people are seeing in their own lifetimes and sometimes in their own short lifetimes. Is this spurring any kind of action on the part of Louisianians to maybe try to mitigate some of these problems?
Well, actually it is. Hurricane Katrina and Rita in 2005 actually speeded up that process. The state now has a 50-year, $150 billion program for both restoration and increased improvements in our protection system, which is largely levees and structures. 50-50, basically. 50% of the money will go to restoration of wetlands and 50% to improvements in the levee systems. The wetland restoration projects are largely divided up into two key ideas. One is to mine the sediment that actually is inside the Mississippi River, inside the levees that keep the Mississippi River from flooding, and to pipe that sediment in to areas that were wetlands and are now open water and recreate landmass in that area. You're basically raising the level to about 3 feet, which allows for it to subside over time and for wetlands to regrow fairly quickly. As a matter of fact, within a year, a lot of these areas are viable wetlands again. That's a very expensive process because you have to pump that material well inland. The state has a 25-mile pipeline that is now under construction that will be building wetlands all along that 25-mile path. That's one of its major projects. The other thing that they're doing is they're trying to figure out a way, a less...
We seem to have lost Mark, so we're going to try to get him back on. We've been talking with Mark Sleepstein, who is an environment reporter for the Times-Picayune. We're talking about some of the environmental disasters that are facing the state of Louisiana, particularly the southeast corner where New Orleans is located. A lot of issues that were brought to strong attention in the wake of Hurricanes Katrina and Rita in 2005, which, among other things, has really encouraged the Army Corps of Engineers to rebuild the levees around New Orleans so that they are a lot more protective than they were back in 2005. And the other problem that we're talking about right now has to do with the loss of wetlands, which an article in ProPublica, which I highly recommend, and we have a link to it on our website, talks about how much the wetlands are disappearing. In fact, these are some of the amazing facts that I learned on when I was at the SEJ conference, that a football field of wetlands disappears every hour in southeast corner of Louisiana. So, Mark, you're back. I don't know where you went, but you're back, right? Hello, Mark. Are you there? Okay. Well, we'll keep talking until we get Mark back on. So, So there's a football field of wetlands that disappears once an hour or every hour along the Louisiana coastline, and that at this rate, it's projected that the coastline of Louisiana before too long is going to actually be right by New Orleans, which would be highly threatening, highly vulnerable place for New Orleans to be, because they've already lost so much protection from the barrier wetlands that used to protect New Orleans from storm surges as a result of hurricanes. And if New Orleans finds itself on the coast, it's just going to be wiped off in a big hurricane. So there's been a lot of effort, as Mark was just beginning to describe, to rebuild the wetlands and to try to re-secure the coastline of Louisiana. Mark, are you back with us?
Yes, I am, I think.
Okay, so I've been trying to sort of repeat what you were saying, so now...
Okay.
So where were you?
I'm not sure. Where did I end?
I think we were talking about the effort that the pipeline that's sending the sediment to the coastline.
Okay, so you have this pipeline project, and it's there will actually be a variety of different pipelines over the next 50 years. But in addition to that, you also have diversions, which will be structures that are placed in the levee system that will allow much larger amounts of water and sediment to get out when there's a major flood of the Mississippi River. So when you have, you hear about these Midwest floods, like in 1993 or in 2011, where there was significant flooding upriver, where you would also be able to have capture of lots of the sediment that ends up in the river as a result of these floods, getting out into the wetlands. And that's a lot cheaper method of doing it, high cost at the front end, but much cheaper when you just have to open it up and you're carrying lots of material out there. But that project also has consequences, which is that it also has lots of fresh water, and it will change the way that fishing occurs, a commercial fishery species, the mix of them, and where they can be found when it is open. So that's something that not all the fishermen are very happy with.
Actually, how will it change it? That sounds like it could be a very serious consequence.
Yeah, it depends. You know, one of the key areas that where fishermen are concerned are those who are harvesting oysters. The state has a historical program where it leases water bottoms, the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico, in shallow water areas, to oystermen to raise oysters. And those areas, when fresh water hits them, they're no longer viable for oysters, so it will kill the oysters. And people are aware of that. Now, the state says that it's going to be designing these things, so that may happen, but it will only happen every once in a while. And in addition, it's planning on providing new areas where oystermen will be able to raise oysters, where it will be more in line with the salinity that they need once those facilities are open. So that's a long-term sort of a view, and the oystermen are, you know, they're short-term, and so they're not really happy with that.
Now, would this be returning that area of wetlands back to a state that it was earlier, or is it going to be more fresh water than it was initially before it got messed with?
The reality is that the Mississippi River changed its course every 500-600 years to 1,000 years. Some were small changes, others were major changes all along the coast, and that is how the coast of Louisiana was historically built over the last 10,000 years. So, yes, and the erosion that's occurred along our coast actually has also increased the speed in which some of these oyster places are actually, you know, areas where oysters are being raised, they're actually getting hammered from the other end, with the areas being too salty on the lower ends of where they were growing oysters. So it's sort of a two-edged sword. If you went back 100 years, the oystermen were not growing oysters where they're growing them now because the salinity was different.
Well, if you're just tuning in, I'm talking this morning with Mark Sleefstein, who is environment reporter for the Times-Picayune in New Orleans, and we're talking about this intersection of environmental disasters facing New Orleans and Louisiana. Now, you were describing to us, when we were talking about a week and a half ago, you were, I guess, visiting the site where they're doing the wetland restoration and discovered that there was an odd substance that was like sprinkled all over the ground, which it sort of brings up another part of the complex of difficulties that your region faces. So why don't you tell us that story?
Sure. I actually was out at the end of the pipeline for one of these pipe projects, and as we're trying to take pictures and talk to the people who are building this new land out there, you basically have this flow of sediment that is pouring out and creating new wetlands, well, new land, basically. And I reached down out of the boat that we were in, and I picked up a handful of sand, and in it was a piece of coal. And then I started looking around, and there were pieces of coal dotting the entire area. And then as we moved back in different locations all along the place where this pipeline had been operating, I found that there was coal, some of it small, and some of it the size of like a softball. And it turned out that there are a couple of coal handling facilities along the Mississippi River that are above the location where the sediment is being mined for these projects. And this, it seemed to be the first time that anybody in the state recognized that there might be a contaminant in this material. There had been concerns raised about, you know, gee, well, are there chemicals or something else in the sediment? And it was, that was largely dismissed based on tests that showed that it, pretty much that that was not a problem. And it was clear from the way that how quickly the wetland grasses would grow on top of this stuff that it didn't seem to be a problem. But now we've raised this question about the coal being captured, which is interesting at least.
And wasn't it not just coal? Wasn't there some petroleum coke in there as well?
Yeah, actually there
and that's
was.
A little more and serious, indeed, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's still, it's petroleum coke is basically a material that is hard but it does have more of a chance of becoming a problem. Smaller little pellets of that.
So, I mean, is it going to be helpful and healthful for the budding wetlands to be built on a whole lot of coal?
Well, I...
Are they going to be mining it one of these days?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, we were sort of joking about that. One of the big problems about these pipelines is that you need to build pump stations along their lines. And so we were sort of joking they can mine the coal that's being carried by the pipeline and use it as the energy source for the pump stations, but that was a joke. The state, to be honest, has not addressed this yet, and it is likely to be addressed because one of the environmental groups, the Gulf Restoration Network, has filed a complaint with the Coast Guard National Response Center, which starts the process aimed at probably ending up with a lawsuit over what the material, you know, where the material is coming from. Those, one of the facilities upriver already is under a consent agreement with the state to cover up the places where the coal is carried over the river so that it doesn't fall out. But and is actually spending, I think, $80 million on that project. But that's going to be a while before it's completed, and there's nothing that the state has done so far to determine how much coal is actually in the river or where exactly it can be found.
Well, and just a little bit more background on this. I mean, I learned when I was in New Orleans that there is, in fact, a whole issue about more coal trains coming through the state of Louisiana and coming close to New Orleans. And it's also a big issue here in Oregon. People are fighting the proposed coal trains that would be going to proposed coal terminals that would then ship this coal to Asia. And so far, most of the terminals in the Northwest have been stopped. So there's, I think, only three left that are still being proposed. But what is the story with coal trains in Louisiana? Where's the coal? Is this the same Powder River coal that's going to the Northwest? And once it gets to New Orleans, where would it go from there?
I think one of the big arguments that's going on right now is from involving the relocation of a rail line that would be taking coal from the west. But most of this coal is actually coming from the east, and actually a lot of it travels the Mississippi River. Remember, the river goes up the Ohio, you know, it connects to the Ohio River and then up into areas that have been traditional coal producers. That material comes down on barges and then is uploaded into these facilities, you know, in big piles, and then it's reloaded onto ocean-going vessels for export. There's a new one of these facilities that is proposed that this rail line actually would connect to, that actually is right next to the location of one of these larger freshwater diversions, and so there are complaints that have been made about that as well. The state has so far approved the initial permitting for that facility, though, despite the fact that the state does have a gubernatorial executive order that requires all projects that the state is involved in to comply with the requirements of the state's master plan, and that diversion project is part of the master plan. So that's one of the things that the environmental groups are citing so far unsuccessfully in trying to stop it.
And so this coal is coal largely produced through mountaintop removal mining?
Yeah. Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit more about the energy resource industry in Louisiana and the impact it has on the state. Because coal is just something that travels through your state, but all the, I don't think they do any mining of coal in Louisiana itself.
No, no, there's
it's the one thing you don't get.
I take that back. There actually is a coal resource in Louisiana. It's soft coal called lignite, and there's a power plant that actually was built in the 80s that is operated. It's a mine mouth facility in Louisiana. And, of course, next door in Mississippi, there are a couple of coal facilities or also lignite coal and also a couple of power plants that are operated using coal.
Well, because one of the things they raise in the ProPublica article is that the concerns about the Louisiana coastline disappearing are not just concerns for Louisiana, but for the rest of the country that's completely dependent on all the energy resources that either are extracted in Louisiana or go through Louisiana ports. So, and I think a lot of people who are familiar with these issues do recognize Louisiana as being a real center of the oil and gas industry, very much like Texas. But as much as I was aware of that before I was at my last trip, I was amazed to see a map of the state of Louisiana with every oil well on the state. And except for one parish, the entire map was just completely dark with dots. And I guess the figure was 250,000 oil and gas wells, including fracked wells.
That's probably as close to accurate. Louisiana was indeed one of the first locations where oil was and gas were discovered, and it has become a major player in the new idea of fracking. And indeed, in northwest Louisiana, there's an area called the Haynesville Shale area around Shreveport, where there have been there are 2,400 wells that have been drilled and are producing natural gas since 2008, and there are a handful of wells that are being developed in on my side of the state, on the eastern side of the state right now.
There's a huge amount of, it's not just the oil wells, but then there's the refineries, this whole infrastructure. You talked about the canals to get out to the oil rigs that were in the wetlands. And then, of course, there's all the offshore oil drilling, and the most famous one, of course, being the BP Deepwater Horizon. But let's talk about this infrastructure and how it appears to me, as an outsider, it kind of overwhelms the state. Do you think that's an overstatement?
Well, I mean, I don't think the state feels overwhelmed. They look at it as you know, a major industry base, or the major industry base of the state. We are indeed, we not only produce quite a bit of oil and gas, which has been slowly dropping off because it's being used up, but we are the conduit for quite a bit of oil and gas that comes from offshore and from other states that move through Louisiana, Texas. There are pipelines that go all along the coast from Texas into Louisiana and then up the Mississippi River. There are, 150 petrochemical facilities between just south of New Orleans and just north of Baton Rouge. There are other material that are needed for petrochemical industry that are all found here in Louisiana. You need the water, and the Mississippi River is a great source of water. You need salt, and we have salt domes galore all up and down our coast. And then you need the oil and gas, and you put all those together, and it makes everything you can think of, from the precursors of plastics to drugs to pesticides, you name it. It's all made here.
And then the other side of it, I guess there's the area, is it between New Orleans and Baton Rouge, is called Cancer Alley, which some people, I guess, in the industry like to say that's a misnomer, but that there are certain health consequences that I believe some of them have been documented. It definitely raises a lot of concerns on the part of people who are working to try to have a cleaner environment.
Yeah. I do not use the name Cancer Alley largely because it's so difficult to prove cause and effect with cancers, and that has not really been done well except within a couple of plants with some specific chemicals like benzene or something like that. But rather, if you want to say it's the asthma alley, that would be a really good term to use. There's no question that there are health effects that have occurred from these facilities, and the state actually is going through a new boom in terms of construction of facilities as a result of the fracking industry, the cheap access to natural gas that's been occurring. There have been quite a few new facilities that have been built.
Well, we're talking this morning with Mark Sleepstein, who is environment reporter for the Times-Picayune of New Orleans, and we're talking about some of the environmental challenges facing his region. He's been reporting on this for many years. I want to get now to political will, because it seems that there's a huge number of problems facing Louisiana. You've talked about how some of them are trying to be mitigated, like trying to rebuild the wetlands, so that seems to me to be a really difficult challenge, especially when you're going to be rebuilding it with coal particles. But I wanted to talk about some of the things, the climate, let's say, the political, social, economic climate in Louisiana, which maybe makes it harder to talk about things. I talked with a couple people. One was somebody who's working to stop the coal trains. And then another one was a reporter who works at public radio, who both said that it's very it's very hard in their region to use the term climate change. People don't want to hear that. So I wonder, is climate change a verboten topic or a buzzword that makes it hard to communicate what your real issues are?
Well, it's not for us. We don't really have a problem, you know, using the word in our articles. Unlike other environmental reporters, I haven't been attacked very much by some call the climate deniers, people who don't quite agree with the majority of scientists who believe, you know, the vast majority of scientists who believe that human-induced changes are resulting in climate disruption. We've been reporting on it for quite a while. In terms of, you know, whether or not our readers believe in climate change, it's hard to tell. I know that our politicians don't like the word, and the majority of, say, the legislature, and most certainly the majority of our congressional delegation, don't use it, and some of them just say they don't believe in it. But the reality is that they also understand that there's a major problem with our coast, and our highly accepting of anything and everything that will restore wetlands. And that's been shown by repeatedly, especially since Hurricane Katrina, the state, there's been a change in the state constitution to require all offshore oil and gas money to go towards coastal restoration. The master plan itself was approved unanimously originally in 2007, and in 2012, when the first five-year update was done, it was approved unanimously. And every year, the annual budget is approved by a vast majority of the legislature. And all of those plans talk about climate change and talk about its effects on Louisiana. The other reality is that for instance, in New Orleans, we most definitely have had to deal with climate change issues in rebuilding the levee system around New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. The Army Corps of Engineers requires sea level rise resulting from climate change to be built into all projects. And indeed, on our eastern side, the walls and levees had about 3 feet added to their 50-year design heights to deal with the Corps estimate of sea level rise resulting from climate change.
Well, I guess the other question I have is, how much can you expect from your local and actually federal elected officials to come down on the oil and gas industry's culpability for some of the problems when so much of the money
yeah,
that gets...
That's a whole other issue. There, you know, the environmental organizations contend that the oil and gas industry needs to pay for their historical effects of their drilling operations, which is significant and which most of the companies agree has happened. However, a majority of the legislature at the moment and the governor contend that the citizens of Louisiana and the legislature generally allow those effects to go into effect, and that the individual lawsuits that are filed by landowners are the proper place for those to occur, and they've done quite a bit to limit those as well, but that in general, the oil and gas industry is too important to force it to do something about its past bad practices. Now, where that ends up remains to be seen. There's a major lawsuit that was filed by the Regional Levee Authority for the New Orleans region on the east side of the Mississippi River against oil and gas, saying you need to do something about the canals. The legislature passed legislation that it believes prohibits, after the fact, the levee authority from taking the suit to court. That issue is now before a federal judge who is going to be hearing that question, whether or not the state law will prohibit that suit, and whether or not other reasons are there to dismiss the suit in November. But at the same time, there are at least two parishes, which are counties in Louisiana, in this area that have filed individual lawsuits that are more aimed at cleaning up past contamination caused by the oil and gas industry, as well as a little bit of the actual canals and other problems that were caused. Those suits were not stopped by the legislature. They were specifically exempted from that new law and are continuing. And there were 28 of those suits against hundreds of oil and gas companies. And the individual lawsuits, what we call legacy lawsuits, also have continued, although their focus has been narrowed and there has been legislation that's drawn out the process that it takes to bring them to fruition in the courts.
Well,
but they're still happening.
Well, one last lawsuit I want to talk about is while we were in New Orleans for the conference, word came out that the federal judge had found BP to be guilty of gross negligence. So I want to talk a little bit about that and maybe throw in the context of a speech we heard the night before from a BP
sure.
mouthpiece.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the gross negligence ruling by a federal judge is in the civil portion of thousands of lawsuits that were filed against BP. And it specifically has to deal with federal government Clean Water Act fines that the company will be facing. The judge basically ruled that in the way that BP drilled the well, it was grossly negligent and thus should be held to a higher standard. Under the Clean Water Act, the company is potentially facing fines of as much as $1,100 per barrel if it were just found negligent. And then for gross negligence, it increases to a maximum of $4,300 per barrel. So if one were to take it to its fruition, the full $4,300 per barrel, the company may face $18 billion in Clean Water Act fines alone. That's not likely to happen because the judge has to go through other processes to determine the ultimate fines that will be done in January in a different court setting. And in doing so, he's likely to be somewhere between probably closer to $7 or $8 billion. That's my off the cuff estimate of what he'll end up doing. But that, remember though, that this has to do, he's also going to have to consider whether or not in a next step, another ruling that will come up probably before that hearing in January, he's going to have to determine whether or not the company did everything it could to stop the flow of oil after the well blew out and what it did during the cleanup. And that really goes to what the chief spokesman for BP said at the conference. He basically made a case for BP on BP's behalf that both the media and environmental groups basically piled on the company immediately after the oil spill and said that these horrible things, basically everything in the Gulf of Mexico was going to die, and so was everything on shore, and all the birds were going to die and everything else. And that hasn't come to fruition. There's actually been a dramatic improvement in the health of the Gulf. The company has spent billions of dollars cleaning up the oil all along the Gulf. The Army Corps of Engineers Coast Guard has determined that it can now stop most of that cleanup operation because things are as clean as they can be. And, of course, there are both amongst the environmental groups and amongst the states those who are highly disagreeing with what BP has said. As part of the Oil Pollution Act, there's another requirement outside of the trial that I was talking about where they have to go through what's called a natural resource damage assessment where they actually determine what effects have occurred as a result of the spill. That process is still ongoing. It's a joint process by federal agencies, by the states as trustees of the public, and by BP, and they all have to agree on what the damages are and then how much money that represents and how much in terms of projects can be done to mitigate those damages. And that's still a process that's way far off in the future before it'll be completed, unless, of course, it's all bundled up into some global settlement of everything, which is still possible.
And we're just about out of time, but there's a whole lot more to talk about here, as I discovered spending a few days in New Orleans. And Mark, I want to thank you very much for joining us.
Sure. Well, thank you.
And we'll have you back on one of these days for me to do a follow-up. Okay, thanks a lot. We've been talking this morning with Mark Sleepstein, who's environment reporter for the New Orleans Times-Picayune, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in, you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. Next week, my guest is Eric DePlace to give us the latest updates on oil trains through the Northwest. My engineer is Kate Welch. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music from New Orleans by Charmaine Neville, I Put a Spell on You. Thanks for listening.
And it's just a few seconds before 11 a.m. You do have it tuned to KBOO Portland. And up next is Health Watch with host Dr. David Naiman. Today he speaks with Dr. Lonnie Simpson about her book, Dr. Lonnie's No-Nonsense Bone Health Guide. And at 11:30 on the Radio Zine, host Kristen Yount speaks with Peter Spendelo, the president of Northwest Veg, and Bonnie Hildebrand, event coordinator, about the upcoming Veg Fest, the environmental impacts of food choices, and the benefits of plant-based diets. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a KBOO member, you can become one. Go to KBOO and click on Donate Today.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the final La Peña Flamenca de Portland of the season. On September 26th, at the Steep and Thorny Way to Heaven, La Peña Flamenca de Portland presents Berto Boyd with Daniel Azcarate and Elena Villa. There will be two performances, one beginning at 7 p.m. and the other at 9:30 p.m. La Peña Flamenca is a not-for-profit cultural association that promotes flamenco performances in Portland. Again, that's La Peña Flamenca de Portland, Friday, September 26th at the Steep and Thorny Way to Heaven on Southeast 2nd Avenue between Madison and Hawthorne in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The purpose of this program is not to prescribe a treatment to individuals. Listeners should consult their healthcare practitioner before attempting any treatment.